on the news in the last month or two because he's a head science investigative for the Pluto mission. You saw him on TV if you watched any of the reports. He's working with Worldview to eventually send some telescope equipment up, and it's a lot less expensive to use these balloons to get up above the atmosphere than it is for rockets. So with all these different contracts that are coming out for this company, they think they're going to be able to drop their price down tremendously, you know, maybe down to around $20,000 for a mission. You know, you want to send up a cosmic ray detector or something, you know, you pay them $20,000 and off it goes, compared to today's prices, which is, you know, probably five times that amount. So that's pretty much it. There's other things. There's India's launch rockets. I've got the Astro that telescope now in orbit, launched on their PSLV rocket. It's their big heavy lift rocket from India. Same one that launched that spacecraft to Mars successfully. Now they launched a space telescope on the polar satellite launch vehicle, the PSLV. So they're doing good. The European Space Agency last week launched another Ariane 5 from French Guiana down in South America, and put a couple more Galileo GPS satellites into orbit. They're developing their own GPS satellite system. So rockets going up all over. We got people coming back. Scott Kelly is still up in the space station with this total of six people now. They no longer have nine. The other three came down. But we'll try to keep up on everything, Dick. But as the years go on, it's going to get even better, more interesting once they start flying people from the United States back to K2RIW. This is WS2N for the SpaceNet Report.
Questions? Go ahead with a question, and start off with your name and your call letter service first.
As Roger, K2JAS, I'd like to know if there's any effort being made to collect all the space garbage that we have up there.
Boy, I doubt it. That sounds difficult. What do you think on that one, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW.
You know, Japan has a project that they're involved with. Their goal is to see if they can do something about it. It's a private company trying to develop that type of system to eventually collect garbage. Some people could use a magnet to attract these things to, and then demagnetize them and put them into different orbits. You know, they all these exotic plans. Japan, I think, has a net idea. They plan on netting things. It's in the works. You know, people are thinking about it. They're trying to plan. Also, everybody is trying to plan where they send stuff up and have it either deorbitive or go into the solar orbit, so you don't have any more garbage going up. In the case of SpaceX, Boeing, and even the European Space Agency with their future Ariane 6 rocket coming now after Ariane 5, they plan on having a return type of system, one form or another, so that we not only don't screw up space, but we don't continue to pollute the oceans with all the stuff that keeps flying back. I guess I hope that answers some part of the question, Roger. Back to you, I guess.
Yes, it does answer some part. Thank you. I appreciate your response. But I know that a lot of these objects can be very small, maybe marble size, at extremely fast speeds that are capable of ripping through orbiting satellites or space stations. And how can you possibly catch that stuff with nets or magnets? It just boggles the mind. Back to you. K2JAS.
Yeah, I'm saying that it's going to be very difficult. on paper, it's easy to say, well, I'm going to send up a spacecraft, I'm going to capture that piece of junk, and I'm going to bring it back, or I'm going to put it in an inert place. On paper, that sounds good. You study what's required for orbital mechanics in order to make your spacecraft have the right three-dimensional velocity, the right velocity X, Y, and Z, the right time, and the right altitude. In order for it to be in the right position at the right time with the right velocity so it can meet up with that piece of hardware on the same plane of orbit, the same altitude of orbit, the same, everything that's in orbit is in a elliptical orbit. You've got to make a matching elliptical orbit. On paper it sounds easy, when you really go and do it, it's kind of difficult. And that's just to capture one piece of hardware. There's a zillion pieces of hardware out there you'd like to capture. So I think if you put forth a heroic effort to capture 10% of the junk that's out there, I think it would cost a small fortune. That's my gut feel on that one. Maybe you've got a different opinion on it, Paul. People have got plans, but do they sound like they're really going to follow through? WS2N, K2LIW.
Well, you know, these are things into the future. Who knows? You've got to get money. Somebody has to pay for this. You know, other countries are going to get together and collectively pay somebody to do this. I don't know. Japan has this, I shouldn't say net, it's really like a, they want to open up a, almost like a sale, and you know, grab a hold of these different things and let the sale through the rarefied atmosphere slow the sale down, and then these parts are going to come back, you know, and then deorbit, you know. So how are you going to do this with tens of thousands of pieces? I mean, just that one satellite that China, you know, blew up and out of space, you know, as a test. We did this, kind of like the same thing one time. You know, tens of thousands of pieces of stuff have come off of that. And some of them are at, you know, ridiculously high heights, not only space station height, but, you know, 400, 500, 600, 800 miles up. So it's going to take centuries probably to do it over time. But there's plans on doing it. It's a problem. I mean, you know, just this last group that I just talked about that came back on the Soyuz TMA-18A, let me drop it, on that mission, they were up there for 10 days. Everybody usually goes up for 6 months, and now you got Scott Kelly and the Russian Karyanko, you know, they're staying up there for a year. But everybody else is, you know, the total of six people up there now, usually staying up there 5-6 months. This group went up for 10 days. Well, actually, two of them went up for 10 days. The pilot, the Russian commander, he gets to stay, and he's going to come back actually in March, and he's going to bring back the other two astronauts that have already been up there 6 months, and they'll be up there a year. Well, the original plan was, you know, just to go up to the space station. The Russians have been doing it lately. They make it in four orbits, you know, 6 hours after launch, and they're docking with the space station. You know, this was planned, you know, 2 weeks ago when they went up. That plan had to change just by, you know, like what Roger told us about too much space junk. There was some pieces that were coming near the space station. That's it. They fired their jets, you know, the and the Zvezda rocket, Zvezda module on the space station. And the space station went to a higher altitude. By doing that, you know, the fuel and the weight, everything is calculated exactly for TMA, you know, 18A, the Russian spacecraft that was planned, you know, that's going up there. So, because the space station is now not only in a different location, but at a higher orbit, fuel requirements weren't enough to do that quick rendezvous, 6 hours in docks. So because of the space junk, and probably some very small piece, but enough that could do a lot of damage, they had to spend an extra in a little over 2 days to get to the space station. They go on a longer flight to get to the space station and dock. So it does have its consequences, that's for sure. Dick, over to you.
I've seen a couple of websites, Paul, where I think it is a college group of guys and girls, Southwest, I think it's in California, that are launching these high-altitude balloons that are making photographs and cosmic ray measurements and solar flux measurements, I think solar wind measurements. Have you seen that series of YouTube videos and other articles about the Southwest group? In fact, one of the most recent pictures they took is of the wildfires that are going on in California. Over to you, Paul, K2RAW.
No, I haven't seen that. There's a lot of people that launch balloons, do a lot of scientific research, including hams, and they'll set up ATV, amateur TV, all kinds of stuff keeps going up in balloons. They have it down in Antarctica. Scientists will launch a big balloon, and it'll float around Antarctica for a couple of days, eventually come back. Actually, they have a mission where the balloon comes back where it started. But there's quite a bit going on, Dick. The one I'm talking about launches these balloons. The ones that are going to have people in it, they're as big as a stadium, like Shea Stadium. For huge balloons, that's what I've been thinking about. One other thing, before it gets too late, I'll have to bring it up, is this new antenna system for the 2020 rover, Dick. It's going to be running 8 gig in the X-band that they're developing for that. I wanted to bring that up and actually ask you a question about the antenna design. Back to you, Dick.
Yeah, a fair amount of the deep space network NASA work takes place at roughly 8.5 gigahertz. Voyager is talking to I think it's about an 8 or 10 foot diameter dish at 8.5 gigahertz, something like 6 watts into it. So you get a lot of gain at 8.5 gigs. If in the day they launched it way back in 1977, if they had the ability to make a reliable transmitter at 20 gigs, they'd get even more gain out of it, as long as you can precisely aim it. So go ahead and ask your question about 8.5 gigs. I've been near that. I've been on the 10 gig ham band since 1990. Not for the last couple of years. I've got to reestablish that system. But I've talked to people. Most of them was Morse code, but half of them were single sideband on 10 gigahertz. I've talked to people in 10 states on 10 gigahertz from my house. Over to you, Paul. And by the way, never run more than 200 milliwatts, 0.2 watts. QRP, 10 gigs, 10 states. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, this guy plans on doing a lot more. They're developing it for the 2020 rover. It's his biggest curiosity, another open one-ton vehicle. That'll also be running on plutonium, similar to Curiosity. But antenna design, they'll have their regular antenna system like they have now on UHF. Right now, the system is they transmit when Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter is over their location. So they'll transmit up to the orbiter, and then the orbiter will send back transmissions on X-band to the deep space network. That's the system that they have now. Now they plan on, not only doing that, but their main way of transmitting, there's going to be an antenna on board. Before I forget, it's called I wrote it down here somewhere. It's circularized, polarized, half E as an echo-shaped patch antenna element. What they're calling it. It's going to be roughly the size of a chessboard, and it's going to be for 8 gig, and it's going to have actuators on there, so you can move it around. So it's a square-looking thing. You know, I've never seen anything that looks like this before. It's supposed to be very lightweight. And they want that to directly connect, you know, transmit to Earth because they'll have more time. Right now, you know, they transmit up to the satellites, you know, roughly 15 minutes a shot twice a day, half-hour transmission rate. Then the satellites, you know, transmit back to Earth. This way, you know, anytime Mars is facing Earth.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
10 hours out of it, you know, Mars has roughly the same time of day as us. I think it's about 40 minutes. Each other. We have the deep space network. They would like to be able to do this. And through some convoluted system, they think they could get this, this 8 gigs through the Earth atmosphere. They're not worried about Mars. Mars has such a rarefied atmosphere. You know, they can send this signal back. I know KA band would be better. You know, it's I think four times as much. They did have that on the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter when it was on the way to Mars. A lot of people think that would be the better way to go, but they only use it as a test bed. They ran quite a few transmissions on the way to Mars, but really haven't used it since, you know, on 32 gig. But this is an 8 gig system that they plan on using, you know, X-band, directly to and from the spacecraft. Back to you, Dick.
The good news about 8.5 gigs, Paul, is that the Earth's atmosphere is extremely transparent at 8.5 gigs. I don't know the exact number, but if someone told me that the total one-way insertion loss is half a dB going through the whole atmosphere, I'd believe it. And if on an extremely heavy rainstorm, the insertion loss went up another dB, I'd believe that too. Yes, you've got a great big suck out of water vapor resonance absorption at around 24 gigs, but 8.5 gigs, the atmosphere is very transparent. So as long as you have enough effective radiated power, enough transmit power, enough gain on the transmitting antenna on the rover on Mars, as long as Mars is properly oriented, you know, the right part of the day, so to speak, to talk to the Earth, and as long as one of the big dishes at Goldstone and Spain and Australia, as long as one of those is aiming at Mars, that reception should work like a charm. I think some direct transmissions have taken place, and the only reason why they're using the orbiters is that the lander in general was uplink power limited to transmit. We dropped to transmit the relatively short distance from the rover up to a orbiter, and then the orbiter with its high gain antenna aims it right back to NASA, gives you a much higher data rate. But now you've got to worry about the timing of the rotation of Mars, the storing of the data on the orbiter, and then the retransmission. To do it directly is a lot simpler. And now that you've got nuclear power on board, you've got a big enough wheelbase so that if you had to set up a large dish and you had to precisely aim it from the orbiter to Earth, from my point of view, that's very doable. I think that some of the information you're looking for, Paul, WS2N, K2RIW.
Yeah, okay, very good. By the way, the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, they have the 10-foot dish that's beaming back the X-band, and they have traveling wave tubes that are 100 watts. No problem with that. But they, you know, Mars Reconnaissance, MRO they call it. MRO is getting older. You know, launched, got there in like 2005, and they're worried about continuing the existence of that. You have a backup with Mars Odyssey, similar type of transmission. That's even older. That went into orbit in 2002. You got the Mars Express, even they could use. That's European Space Agency. Deal with them. If they run into a problem, they can use that. But they would like to do something, because there's no planned future communication satellites that are right now planned to go to Mars. So, you know, you might have two of these robots. Well, actually, 3, you still got Odyssey running around. Opportunity. You have Opportunity and Curiosity, and then the 2020 rover you'll have. And these things won't have some, you know, they've got to be able to send signals back. And yes, you're right, they did have they have communications in the beginning, just in case they did have a transmitter from the surface direct. That's not the way to go with all these pictures and data going up in the satellites as a repeater. Back to you, sir.
Yeah, the satellite's big dish and its traveling wave tube and its precise aiming gives you a much higher data rate. The longest path is the one from Mars orbiter back to NASA on the Earth, the short path, where you don't need so much ERP and antenna gain is from the surface up to the orbiter. I can see how that repeater system gives them a high data rate. And you've got the resources on the lander to generate the power, but to if you try to put an 8-foot dish on the lander and then properly position it as you're traversing, see, as it is right now, I think they have the ability with a VHF uplink to an orbiter to be moving across the surface of Mars at the same time you're transmitting data. To do that with an 8.5-foot dish, let me think now. My 2-foot dish had a 3-degree beamwidth, so an 8.5-foot dish, I think we're talking about a small fraction of 1 degree of beamwidth. To try to keep an antenna aimed to the nearest fraction of 1 degree in azimuth and elevation while the lander is moving across the surface of Mars, that's a difficult requirement. If you were doing it with a phased array where you could electronically steer, and now the electronic steering could accommodate all the bumps and grinds of the surface you're traveling over, that's one way to do it, but that's one of those situations where to talk about, let me drop. To talk about a relatively high power, high gain, electronically steered phased array in azimuth and elevation, well, that's a mouthful. And the number of failure modes that could give you is sort of out of sight. I'm glad to see that they've got 3 separate orbiters to talk from the lander up to the orbit and then back to the Earth. So that gives them a degree of redundancy. But I guess you're saying those orbiters are getting a bit agey, they're getting a bit old, and I guess NASA is starting to worry about losing some of those backups. I think you're telling me the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, MRO, is the one they use, sounds to me, like 98% of the time. Do they ever sometimes use the others, or is that the one with the highest effective radiated power, and it's the newest one, and therefore they're using it? So when it comes to the uplink of data from a rover to Earth, are they using primarily just one of those orbiters right now, Paul? WS2N, K2RIW?
Yeah, the main one is MRO, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. It's a very big unit. Naturally, it's all solar-powered. Mars Odyssey was up there before it. Smaller, but still operating. Had Mars Global Surveyor before that. That quit working probably 10 years ago. That was good. Now, you know, these were all science research spacecraft that went up. The MRO has the high-rise camera on board that they can take a picture of something as small as a small picnic table on Mars. They've taken pictures of the rover on Mars. It's taken pictures of the Phoenix spacecraft when it was coming in on a parachute. It took a snapshot of that. Took a picture of Curiosity as well. And incredible. I mean, they do have another one up there called MABEN, and that's doing a lot of research. It's in an elliptical orbit, and it's not really set up for repeater operation. And in fact, India has one up there too. They have the another one that that really you can't really use. No other planned orbit is going, so need some kind of a system. It looks like about size of a checkerboard, you know, maybe a third of a meter square. That's about what this thing looks like. I'm sure more will come out over time of what this thing really looks like, Dick. As far as power, as far as timing out, the power that they're going to have is still plutonium. 38 fresh 239. That will be it's a short supply. I think there's something like 40 pounds left in the whole United States. They're running out of that stuff, so that's why a lot of future missions are going to be done, including the next one to Jupiter with solar panels, big solar panels, because of the inverse square law. But running out of that stuff. Back to you.
One of the articles I've read says there's an effort afoot right now to reestablish more plutonium to be used for these radioactive thermal generators for spacecraft. You have to manufacture more of it. I think plutonium-239 has a half-life of 87 years. So when you make a thermal electric generator out of that stuff, you got quite a bit of legs to that. You got quite a bit of life to it. And deploying that as opposed to a great big set of solar sails and properly orienting them, I think it is a simpler process. And as you go deeper into space, you're sort of forced into it because that solar energy falls off awful fast. But it was a question I was going to ask you along these lines. Forgotten it. Let me look at my notes. Oh, yeah. One of the things I did this week, let me drop it. You can tell by the number of times I've said this in the past. I was very curious as to the Apollo lunar mission, where they really land. Mare Tranquility Base, on the moon. The moon always aims the same face at the Earth. And if you look at the point in the center of the moon from our point of view, the sub-Earth point, that's essentially on the equator of the moon, and Tranquility Base is around 23 degrees to the right of that point, 23 degrees to the east, we would call it, its longitude on the moon. And that's where Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin landed. And if you look at the phase of the moon at that time, that point was extremely close to the terminator. Therefore, you could say on the place where they landed on the moon, the local clock would be reading around 6:30 in the morning. And so at that time, they were getting a reasonable temperature, and they're good for a couple of days before it starts getting too hot. As the lunar months continued, the terminator, from our point of view, moves to the left and exposes them to a higher and higher sun angle and higher and higher temperatures. High noon temperature on the moon is not tolerable. The midnight, it's too hot. The midnight temperature on the moon is too cold. So the astronauts, I mean, the guys in the back room were doing all these calculations for them. From their point of view, all they had to do is land at the right spot on the moon where and avoid the equator, avoid the craters and the boulder field. Let me drop. In reality, every one of those missions had to be carefully planned for the right spot as far as the local temperature for that portion of the lunar day, which is 27 and a half days long. High noon on the Earth, you and I think it lasts from 11 in the morning until 1 in the afternoon. That's 2 hours. Well, on the moon, high noon lasts for 57 hours. And boy, would you cook in that amount of time. No local water body to mediate the temperature for you. There's no atmosphere to take away the hot gases and so on. So you've got the exact same problem with Mars. Buzz Aldrin was interviewed on, I think it was one of the news programs on CBS television, not this weekend, last weekend. He's very disappointed that NASA is not planning a set of manned expeditions to Mars. And I think he's thinking very simplistically. He's an 85-year-old guy. He started to talk slowly. But the actual details of putting men on Mars, so life-threatening, so difficult, so expensive, I think he's being quite naive of saying derogatory things about NASA, that they're too stodgy for not planning manned missions to Mars. They were talking about the SpaceX Dragon will be able to bring various things to Mars. And I presume you're talking about unmanned missions and maybe soil recovery and return missions. Let me drop. But I'd like to believe that Elon Musk is not really discussing manned missions to Mars at this time. Is that true, Paul? WSQN, K2LAW?
Well, he'll discuss it. He has plans way down the road. I mean, that's his ultimate goal. And he's said that in many interviews. First of all, I'll go back one step. I think we got no more than 40 pounds of this plutonium left for our space missions. And to give you an idea, it goes quick. You know, the Curiosity has 9 pounds on board, you know, so a couple more missions and it's going to be gone. And in fact, the stuff that we have, we're losing our, you know, you got 87 year half life on it. We haven't made anything in, you know, 25 years. So, you know, the stuff that's sitting around is already, it's already losing power, you might say, in relation to its density. So, I mean, you'd have to send heavier stuff. So it's going to go quick. And as far as the prime meridian on the moon, I think goes right through the face, whatever part is looking at us. That's how they get all these prime meridians on all the different planets, everything. You know, some of them are locked, like Pluto and Charon are locked looking at each other. And that's what becomes the prime meridian on them. And then they go from there. And as far as, let me drop it here. I'm going to time this out. And, you know, I'm forgetting John, by the way. John had a question about the pictures of Pluto. That's on my mind. As far as sending people to Mars, Elon Musk, well, you know, he'll talk about it. He's got goals of building a rocket bigger than the Falcon 9, called the Mars Colony Transport. And the diameter, for instance, of one Falcon 9, I think is around almost 13 feet. Mars Colony Transport would be 3 times that diameter, so roughly 30 or 33 feet in diameter. And more powerful than the Saturn V. He's got plans. He just needs some time and money, Dick, but he's thinking about it. Yeah, and then, of course, the sample return missions would be unmanned. Back to you, Dick.
That's a catchy title. Mars Colony Transport. MCT. Oh. And 3 times SpaceX and Dragon, if I understand you. On paper, it looks good. I may be pessimistic, but I don't think and my grandchildren are going to see a human being standing on Mars. But it's just a belief. John, I know you've got some further questions for Paul, so go right ahead. KC2WGB, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Yeah, I think they should add one way to the name Headrock. In the front of it, just one way trip. But I was just wondering, Paul, do you know how many pictures have come back from Pluto? You know, once in a while on the news I see a picture, but I've been on the web looking around. I haven't been able to find a series of pictures. So maybe you can tell me what's going on if you have that information. KC2WGB.
Oh, okay. Yeah, well, you know, the initial 5% was in the beginning, and then they stopped. They were sending technical data and things like that. It's going to take 16 months total to get all the data back. They just started sending large amounts of data back last week. So the latest came in on September 10th. So you won't see anything until this Friday. Every Friday they'll release more information. That's going to be the date. every Friday more stuff will come in. So you see a series of pictures now about Sharon and Pluto, and they're more detailed than the original pictures. You know, you see some close-ups and things. And if you go to NASA.com, I think around the third or fourth main article, as you scroll down, you'll find something on Pluto. You click on that, and you'll have the latest. I think there's four images, maybe five, that they'll have from September 10th. Back to you, John.
Very good, Paul. Yeah, I'll try that again. I was there about 2 weeks ago. There wasn't much there as far as pictures. There was some written information, but okay, I'll double check that. Maybe I can look at some more stuff, and I like the fact that the resolution's improving. Good. Back to you, Dick. KC2WGB.
You have a tablet. I don't know if you have a tablet, John, but the app Safari, it's Pluto. You download that. It comes in automatically. It almost comes in my email, you know. Once in a while, my tablet will go off. It'll have the latest pictures, the same pictures that you're getting from NASA, or even space.com has it too. Go to space.com, you scroll down, and you'll find the whatever the latest pictures is for Pluto. They'll have the same things as well. Back to you, Dick.
In the case of New Horizons and these Pluto pictures and Pluto data, I am guessing that's all stored in a solid-state memory, and for the next 16 months that's slowly being read down to us at something like a couple of kilohertz bit rate, rough guess on my part. In the case of the three orbiters around Mars now, are they storing data on tape recorders and then sending it back, or is that also solid-state memory? Part of the reason I'm asking that is that Voyager, launched in 1977, I believe it stores data on a tape recorder, what you and I would call an old-fashioned tape recorder, obviously a mil-spec version, space-qualified version. And so when that tape is exposed to the hard vacuum of space, all those crazy temperatures, how long is the tape going to last? How often can you reuse that section of tape before it breaks, wears out, gives you bit error rates, and so on? So of the three orbiters of Mars right now, that's storing memory data in solid-state memory or a tape recorder, to your knowledge, Paul? WS2N, K2LAW.
Yeah, they all have flash drives. And, with Voyager, it's actually an 8-track system, so it doesn't get to the end of the tape and just, you know, rewind. It just keeps going around and around. That's how Voyager does it. And, so many different units did that. Ulysses did it. That went into polar orbit around the sun. In fact, Hubble, the original recording device on Hubble was a tape drive system. Of course, that's all been replaced with all these spacewalk. So, it doesn't look like the old A-track. I mean, it's a box, probably about, 15 inches long. 8 inches deep. It's a solid-looking thing. I've seen pictures of the one on Voyager, and you don't even see the tape or anything. It's buried in this contraption. So, it does run like an E-track tape. Back to you.
A twirling orbit question.
You've got it, Joe.
It's right up your alley. The spacecraft that's currently being launched today, that's exploring these, planets and sending pictures back, the receiving equipment on it now, compared to what we launched 40 years ago, how much more sensitivity do these receivers exhibit than what was launched 40-something years ago? Back to you.
That's for you, Dick.
Yeah, I've been involved in some of the electronics that goes on to some spacecraft. And the thing you got to worry about most, that you have the ability to put a beautiful low noise front end, gallium arsenide field effect, or indium phosphide, some of these really fancy super low noise FET light transistors in the front end to give you a real low noise figure. That's the good news. Or you better have a relay that can bypass it. Because if it goes dead, if it sees a lightning burst, you know, it's looking straight down with a high-gain antenna at a thunderstorm that's in Earth orbit, and it gets a flash of energy, and it wipes out that front end, all of a sudden your 20 dB gain FET amplifier with a super low noise figure becomes a 30 dB attenuator, and your noise figure goes through the roof. As such, it is my guess that many of these systems have a crystal diode mixer front end. It doesn't give them great sensitivity, but their problem is they are not uplink limited. You've got a 10 kilowatt transmitter on Goldstone into a 240 foot dish, and blast a lot of power in that uplink. And by having a very simple mixer front end, you're as safe as you can get, unless you're willing to put a bypass relay. Now you got to worry about that bypass, the transfer relay failing. So it is my guess that many of these receivers have a very simple mixer front end, maybe without a preamplifier, because they're willing to blast the power in the uplink. I'm not positive, but that's my guess, Paul, because the spacecraft that I've been involved with, if they didn't have a bypass relay, they had a low noise front end, 50% of the time they got a space failure of unknown origin.
Repeater, timeout.
Mother Nature can be pretty nasty out there, with solar wind, solar prominences, coronal mass ejection, high power cosmic rays. There's a zillion ways that a low noise front end. The good news is that these transistors can give you very low noise figures. Talk to anybody that used a low noise front end on his 10 gig equipment, and the first question you can ask him is, how often have you replaced that preamp because you had a mysterious wipeout? The really low noise devices are extremely delicate. We're talking about 0.7 micron type gate width, as they call it, or I think they call it gate length. Very tiny, very sensitive thing. One cosmic ray hitting it can wipe it out. So I wonder if any of the reports you've read, Paul, mentioned receiver sensitivity or gave you a schematic diagram. And when you look at the schematic diagram, I'll bet you didn't see LNA in the front end. In other words, A stage labeled low noise amplifier. I'll bet you they bypass it and just go straight to the mixer from the antenna. That's a guess on my part. WS2N, K2LIW. Is that the KE2EJ that I heard?
K2JAS, I have a question.
Okay, let Paul answer that first, and then we'll pass it over to you, Roger. Go ahead, Paul.
No, I have no comparison. See, I mean, I can tell you the size of the antennas that they use, like 12-foot dish for Voyager, 10-foot dish for MRO, you know, Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. But that's it. You know, I mean, they'll show, you know, holes inside the, you know, the center of the antennas for alignment purposes, looking back toward Earth. But I haven't seen anything about LNAs, the low noise amplifiers. So, and Joe asked that question, and I got another question from somebody. So, oh, by the way, Dick, Mars Colony Transport, they have engines too. Anybody wants to look it up? The Raptor engines. You know, they make the Merlin engines on the Falcon 9 look teeny tiny. I had to throw that in case anybody wants to look these things up. It's fascinating what this guy has planned. He's got it together. I'm telling you. Back to you, Dick.
Minute, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead, Roger, with your question.
Okay, very quickly. We were talking about collecting space garbage. I was just wondering if anyone had any thoughts on blasting it to smithereens with some type of laser. Back to you.
Almost out of the question. Turns out Neil deGrasse Tyson was asked that exact question. On paper, it sounds good. When you're in space and you blast something, take a big object and make it into a whole bunch of small objects. A whole bunch of small objects floating around in space is almost as bad. You don't vaporize it. It doesn't disappear. You just blast it into smaller objects, and it's no real gain. So he strongly recommends not doing it. You guys have just heard technet number 1,573 in the series. We'll be back next week. We'll settle some of these issues next week, it says here. Be kind to each other. Try to enjoy it. Radio is fun. Over to you, John. KC2WGB, K2LAW in the Tech Man.
KC2WGB, once again, I'd like to thank everybody for joining us, and keep the questions coming, and we might have some answers. So, everybody be kind and enjoy it. Remember, it's a hobby, gentlemen. Good night, Dick. Good night, Paul. KC2WGB.
I thought you were going to say, good night, Mr. Calabash, no matter where you are, or something like that. Was that the... Who used to say that? Somebody way back in our time. Who used to say that, John?
Jimmy Durante. Good night, Mrs. Calabash, wherever you are.
Am I hearing a television set in your background there, John?
My granddaughter on the computer with a cell phone in one ear and the keyboard going, it's the zoo.
Fantastic.
Because of your count was 73 for the amount of nets, I just thought of that.
What was that again, John? I mean, Paul?
Last two numbers of your count on the amount of nets was 73. It just dawned on me.
Okay, our last net was 1,573. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now.
Bobby, good night, Nick. Good night, Paul. Talk to you guys not along. KC2WGB.
Hey guys, W3NH on that this Calabash thing. I looked that up a long time ago. They never knew definitively who Mr. Durante was talking or saying goodnight to. They theorized it was a wife, girlfriend, and I think a boarding house or something. So anyway, that was never figured out. You can Google it and see. W3NH clear.
Yeah, another mystery. Thanks for that info.
Good night, all. I really enjoyed it. This is Roger, K2J.
K2JRS, K6GPZ. Roger, can you call me on my home number? It's very important.
I will.
Good evening, K6GPZ, clear.
Good night, guys. Enjoyed it. K2UPN.
Good night, Rich.
Whiskey Free November Hotel. William, that microphone of yours, that looks like a classic. Is that true? Over to you, William. And Rich, K2UPS, mobile, most likely. Where are you located tonight?
As the usual spot where I am on a Saturday, or early Sunday morning, I guess. I'm in Pennsylvania, between Breezewood and Carlisle, on the Pennsylvania Turnpike, heading back to New York.
Go east, young man. So you arrive at your eastern destination, what, in another 5 or so hours?
About that, probably about 5:30 or so. We'll be in Melville. Then we're going to take the second trailer to Farmingville and then get back to Queens. Probably be done around 7:30, 8 o'clock, thereabouts.
And then you got a little bit of furlough time?
Just about 24 hours. I'd start up again Tuesday morning, 6:30.
Sounds like you're following a plan. you've done this roughly how many times so far? I mean, with minor variations, but this exact scenario, done this, what, about 200 times or so, Rich?
I've been on this particular run for over 4 years now. And you figure if I do it, let's say 46 times a year, taking out 6 times for vacation, it's probably pretty darn close to 200, if not over, on this run.
By now, some of those roads must be burned into your memory, memorized, so that if last week they replaced some of the macadam on one of those roads, you know about it, don't you?
Yeah, I can read the road pretty good with my butt. Even if I'm in the back, in the sleeper berth, I can tell by the road, the sway, the curves and stuff, pretty much where we are, and I don't even have to be looking out the window.
That's an amazing navigation system. You can feel the road and know roughly where you are, which is not too different from what our submarines do. Some of our nuclear submarines look at the gravity, the change in the gravity constant when they're in different portions of the ocean. The ocean's got a whole bunch of mass concentrations. Gravity-wise, it's got a bunch of bumps. So as they travel through the ocean, the navigation system recognizes those gravity bumps and says, yes, I know where I am. I don't need a GPS. I don't have to come up to the surface. I don't have to communicate with the outside world. The gravity of the bumps of what they're traveling through tells them what they are, where they are. Over to you, Rich, KQIW.
Now, that's pretty cool. I was not aware of that. And I wonder if the gravity itself changes over time. Probably not enough, or maybe if it does, they can have a calculation for that as well. I always thought, too, that they use to some extent, don't they? Or do they have the capability of navigating by the magnetic field?
I don't think they use magnetic field very much. When the sun comes along, the sun's capable of doing some really nasty things to that magnetic field. But the gravity mass concentrations, those change very slowly. So they're very dependable. I'm going to go away. Bye-bye for now. Nice talking to you, Rich. KTUPS, enjoy the trip. KTUIW, clear.
They do use a lot of gyros, Dick.
Yeah, but gyros drift.
That's true.
If I've been below the surface for a solid month, I wouldn't trust the gyro beyond a couple of days. Whereas those gravity concentrations, I think they stay for 1,000 years.
Yeah, until a tsunami.
Okay, interesting stuff. 73, Dick. John, we'll catch you again. KTUPS Mobile.
All right, Rich. 73, talk to you down the log. KC2WGB. Oh, Dick, by the way, if you're still listening, I finally completed my equipment collection. I got my Rudy. I'll have it Thursday.
Yeah, what you really need, John, is a couple of pieces of test equipment. You're a little shy.
Yeah, I've been watching for a roadie for quite a few years, and one came up, and I was able to get it, so I'm pretty happy about that. So the week went well. Good night, Dick, and have fun.
Yeah, the one thing I missed, the roadie you got, is that a single generator or a VNA?
Oh, VNA, yep. VNA, and the fella I bought it from just got it back from Rudy on a calibration trip 3 weeks ago. So, good shape.
Out of curiosity, is that the Rudy that goes to 8 gigs or the Rudy that goes to 3 gigs?
20.
Wow. You know the model number?
Yes. It's a, it's Zeta Victor Mary.
No number after it, just a Zebra Victor Mike?
That's correct, and from what I understand, it has all the options. A lot of them.
Make a guess as to roughly when it was manufactured, though, John.
I won't know until I get it, Dick. I couldn't find out any information on it at all as far as manufactured date or the original price. I couldn't find either.
Yeah, I think you got a beauty. And if it works half as well as the one that I used for 12 solid years, every single day, you're going to fall in love with it.
Well, I hope so. I have it shipped direct from the seller right up to the Cal Lab so they can check and make sure those stickers are official and that, you know, all the functions work, and then they're going to send it down to me. So that's why it's taken a few days.
It'll take you a while to memorize the various functions in the owner's manual, and the owner's manual and the operation on it differs a fair amount compared to Agilent. Go ahead.
Yeah, I imagine it is going to be quite a learning curve on it, but I don't have the manual yet. I'm trying to procure a manual. He didn't have a manual for it. He didn't even have the operation guide, you know, there's nothing. So, and it's all, I think, APC7 connectors on it. So I got quite a bit of connectors. I think I'll be all right, and I have the calibration kit for it.
Yeah, the one I was using had SMA connectors, or the precision equivalent of SMA connectors on the front panel. And you don't have to spend a fortune on the test cables, because the calibration calibration procedure built into that thing if you've got a moderately good Cal kit. It takes out all the personality of your test cables. That thing can do some magic, John. So you have the option of spending a small fortune on the test cables, but I don't think you need to.
I think you're right, Dick. I think the cables I have will be sufficient. And like the test lab was telling me, he said, they're not going to calibrate it because there's no necessity to calibrate it. All they'll do is put the certified Cal kit on. If it comes within range, he says, that's it. The 12-point function's working. That means it's okay. So he said, even if you get a slightly damaged connector on it, it will write that out too.
That's exactly what I'm saying. It has the ability to take out all the personality of the test cables, as long as you don't put another dent in the cable, so to speak, and bend it at right angles. And the one I was using, I think I told you, you can calibrate it in February, and you retest the Cal in November, and nothing has moved. Whereas the Agilent, I had to recal it every 8 hours.
Yeah, I've seen my Agilent, not the newer one, but the older one, drifted quite a bit. But it would hold it for a couple of hours, you're right. But if I, like, the next day, no, it would have slight perturbations in it. Okay, I'll let you know how I make out, sir. And I'm not worried about instruction booklet. I got you. KC2WGB.
Now, I can tell you about quite a few of the quirks and how to get around it. As I said, I use that thing every day for almost 12 solid years. Started off hating vector network analyzers until they supplied that to me. And it took me about a month to get past my my reluctance, and I suddenly realized, ooh, this thing can really do things. And some very nice patents came because of what that thing can do. I'd like to believe the owner's manual is downloadable, but even if not, if you learn a couple of tricks, the front panel is reasonably user-friendly. Over to you, John.
Yeah, I'm hoping it's intuitive in a way that as I work with it, I'll be able to pick up some skills with it. Rode instruction manuals on one of the ones that I was looking at, it's a much more expensive one than this one, was $600 just for the manual. So in use, they're going to be pricey.
The way that thing is designed, even if you can only find the user's manual for the version that goes to 3 gigs or 8 gigs, that's going to give you what you need, John. What brand name and model number of calibration kit do you own? And is it an SMA calibration kit?
Yeah, I have SMA. I have the APC-7s, APC-35s, I think. And there I have some kits in Weinshell. I have some in HP. I have some in Tektronix. And then there's another one. I think Murray. I have a Murray kit also.
Turns out Murray makes all of those kits. Almost all of those brands buy a Murray kit and put their brand name on it. Murray is the real source of those Cal kits. They do a beautiful job. We also discovered that Mini Circuits makes 50 ohm terminations, and if you buy the ones that are not $1 a piece, but you buy the ones that are $3 a piece, they were good for better than 40 or 45 dB reflection coefficient. Over to you, John. K2LAW.
That's good news. Those prices are cheap. You know, you look at some of those connectors, adapters and things, some of them really get like crazy out of them. Especially the cables. I don't know what the hell is going on with cables, but I was able to procure quite a few of the good cables for a very reasonable price. But some of those HP cables that are like 2 meters long are like $3,000. What are they out of their minds?
I will admit the cable is done with extremely high quality, very low reflections, viewed with a time domain reflectometer. But you don't need that. The 12-point Cal procedure can take out all those idiosyncrasies. I gotta go away. Enjoy. Bye-bye for now.
Okay, Dick, have fun. I'll talk to you down a lot. KC2WGB clear. KD2CBV. KC2WGB. Nothing heard. KC2WGB clear. N2XJN, KC2WGB. Nothing heard. KC2WGB clear.